You know, I always think, we know when the Lord is coming, that like when he does come, he's always like, he catches me like leading somebody to Christ, you know, as opposed to like stuffing my food, my mouth with a burger or something like that, you know. I want to be doing something honorable, you know, so. But since we don't know, you know, we just have to be ready, don't we? Hey, I'd like Jeff Schaefer and Ed Noggle to come up here for just a moment, please. We are, and we I've grown very fond of the term church family. I think that that's very much what we're like and how we comport ourselves here. And come on over here, Ed, if you would. You know, as with any family, there are things that different family members do that other family members may not be as aware of, right? So, like, you know, when you're raising your kids, and they'll say something like, well, you don't do anything for me, right? Or I never get anything. Maybe your kids have never said that to you before, but you know what I'm saying, right? Because they just don't realize. Well, I got to tell you that these two men here, for years since I've been here, and it was so clear to me, especially these last few weeks, and it was very clear to me a year and a half ago, particularly with Ed, and this has always been true. When Ed became our head trustee, and then Jeff has always taken on the task of our property and keeping it cut. I mean, other people help, but he really is on top of that all the time, how we mulch, the flowers, the hedges, all that kind of stuff. I just want to tell you that in terms of Ed being the head trustee, it is one of the most thankless jobs that you can do. Because things still have to happen. You get called at the most inconvenient times. Stuff has to be fixed. You got to figure out things. In other words, some people fix things, you know, years before, and then you get to fix it again without, you know, a lot of sins embedded in the place. You know what I'm saying? That you don't know about until it becomes a problem. All I got to tell you is, it humbles me, the amount of time that these two men give to this church. And as far as I know, very few people ever thank them for what they do. And I'll say this, they haven't told me this, but I just observe this. There are a lot of times that they give time. There's a lot of times when they could turn in receipts that they don't turn in receipts for things that they fix and things that they do. And we would be much the poorer of it if it were not for them. So I just want to tell you two, Ed and Jeff, that you humble me, and I don't know how I could ever pay you back for all that you do for this church. And you need to know that because they give themselves selflessly. I think of Ed, who's rebuilt those swings in our swingy thingy. I can't tell you how many times. I mean, he's rebuilt those things because they just get destroyed, you know. And then the vision that they have and the love that they have. And Jeff is always saying to me, Pastor, let me help you. You know, he's just, it's just what you want. That's always what he says, you know. And I know that year and a half ago, there wasn't a day that Ed was not here every day doing something. Can we just give them a hand? Thank you. Thank you very much.
The truth really is that Jeff does most of the work. I just point things out.
Jeff, yeah, so.
He's a good boss.
Yeah. Consistent with most bosses, right? Fix that. Yeah.
And we need this done now.
Yeah, but I just want to say too that, like, if they give you a call and ask you for some help, I'm fond of saying, many hands make light work, right? If everybody pitches in a little, no one should have to do a lot. Isn't that true?
Amen.
All right. So thank you very much. Okay. So obviously today is Father's Day. And I have in mind some things I want to share with you related to Father's Day that I think are very important. So I don't know how many of you know this, but the in the Old Testament and the New Testament, the economy in those days would be largely what we would call agrarian. They were farming communities. And they were much like us. They were, in many respects, like big families. So you'd have a town like Bethlehem, even Jerusalem to a certain degree. But they were Bethel. They were small communities around farming groups of people, or people who raised sheep or cattle or whatever. And they would organize themselves around a group of people called elders. So it would be the elders of the community who would help to bring some kind of organization or they would preserve the tradition in that particular community. So if you were to go to a city and it was a walled city, and all cities were walled back then, and they had gates, and at the gate, elders would meet sometimes later on in the day, and they would meet there at the gate, the city gate. And if people in the farming community outside the city or people inside the city had, if they wanted wisdom about a particular thing, they would find the elders at the city gate, and they would ask them a question about something that was troubling their life, something that had to be resolved within the family. Those elders would oftentimes adjudicate crimes that were committed in the community. And so they were pretty influential. And they were usually older. And they were older because usually when you're older, you have this longitudinal perspective, right? So you've seen the same thing happen many times over time in various ways. You see it for what it is. It's the same thing, but it happens. And when you're younger, you don't always have that perspective. You know, what's happening now seems like a crisis, but the elder has seen it happen several times before, and he has perspective. And so he can give you wisdom. So so that's kind of, and those elders were, in almost all cases, they were fathers, and they had families. And as elders, they had to represent the community, but their families kind of had to be well run. And if they weren't well run, then the authority that elder had would be undermined. He wouldn't have any credibility. If his wife was not respectful, if his children were not disciplined, it would undermine his ability to rule, to guide in that community. In a certain way, the elder of a church is predicated on that as well. So we don't have all of our elders here because it's a kind of a holiday weekend, but so Ed and who else is here? Ed Kevin. Yeah, so Ed, Kevin. Rich has been an elder. We're gonna get him back here one of these days. But we still consider him to be an elder because he's once you've been ordained as an elder, you're kind of an elder, you're just not functioning as an elder at the time. I don't think we have any more, but here today, but they're the people that are supposed to help give guidance to this church. And if their families presently are not well run, any advice that they might have to give to you, you might especially if it had to do with family or those kinds of things. So I want to talk about, how those two offices, the elder that was a part of the New Testament and Old Testament community and the elders that are part of our church today, those things are never possible unless there are young men who choose to live their lives in a disciplined way, who embrace wisdom, who seek wisdom. If you want to be wise, you have to run with the wise. And there are some people who choose to be foolish, and they hang out with people who are foolish. So we have this neighbor. So when we first moved in almost 2 years ago, there was a woman there. She had, I think the son was about 17, and I'm not sure how old the daughter was. So during that almost 2 years, you could tell that there was no father in the home, and he had a car, and it was a convertible, and he would tool up and down the road, peel tire. They would sit up on the back of the trunk and go up and down the road, which is a really dangerous thing to do. I don't know if you know that. Like, if you accelerate real fast, somebody's going to roll out of that and off the back of the car, right? So it was pretty clear that there wasn't a whole lot of discipline in the home. And I just discovered this past few weeks that the mother's just moved out. She can't control her son anymore, who apparently in this last year or so got his girlfriend pregnant. And so now this, I think, 18-year-old guy and his girlfriend are living in this rental across from us. And they have this baby. And so for the last 2 weeks or so, they've had other younger people over there, and they party. And then during at night, they're getting revved up for July 4th, because almost every night they have fireworks going off in their backyard at 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. Well, there's a built-in there's a built-in problem there, don't you think? And it's not going to be but a matter of time before something terrible happens. A self-destruct button of sorts. Because this young man cannot be controlled. He has no wisdom about how to comport his life, what is best. I mean, I don't know about you, but when we get our kids down to sleep, the last thing that we wanted going off outside the house was, you know, an M80 or fireworks or whatever, right? Because you wanted them to sleep. That's not where they're at. The role of the father historically has always been really crucial. There are 17 million children who are fatherless in our world today, in our country. In Richmond, a couple of years ago, Richmond, Virginia, it was determined that 86% of the families are fatherless. If you can imagine, 86%, that's 14% of those kids grow up in a traditional home. And we know that culturally, we know that the research, the data says that the single biggest predictor of poverty are unwed mothers. If you want your children to grow in poverty and probably stay in poverty, then provide for them a home where there's only one parent, usually that of a mother. So the role of the father is huge. And I think that because we have downplayed the importance culturally, we've downplayed the importance of the role of the father, it has done nothing to help us. It hasn't done anything to help us. C.S. Lewis says this. He said, "We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful." So what he's saying here is that we're raising generations of children without any character, any sense of virtue. We don't teach them things like honor, like hard work, and the benefits that come from that. And because we make fun of, we poke at people who live their lives honorably, we're surprised when those same people later on turn on us. You know, when I was a youth minister, the most terrifying time of any of the kids that I knew as a youth minister, whether they were from grade school all the way up and into high school, but the most terrifying time was middle school for them because of what they were afraid their peers would say and how often they would be betrayed. When my kids were in high school, think about this. You have this group of friends that you care about. and you hang out all the time in school, and you make plans for the weekend that you're going to go and do something together, whatever it is, could be a great thing, a lot of fun. And then Friday night, when you text your friend and say, hey, what's going on? Are we going to do this or not? No, I'm not going to do it. Well, why not? Well, something else came up. And what came up was something better came up. And those friends dumped you. Where's the honor? Where's the virtue? I mean, how painful that must be to know that you've just been cast aside because the perception was that whoever you made plans with, something better came along than you. Now, what does that do to the psyche, to someone? Do you do that to your friends? If you make dinner plans with friends and these other friends come along and say, we'd rather have dinner with you, do you dump your friends that you have dinner plans with? And if they found out, I mean, if our children do that to someone else, we should castigate them. Because it's a horrible thing. It's a terrible message. We make men without chests. We're raising generation after generation of kids that have less and less of a sense of virtue, of goodness, of ethics. And we need to fix it. So let's look at this text that was read, that Brianna read, because this is the role that a father, one of the roles that a father plays, ought to play in the life of their children. And so if you have your Bibles and you want to turn to it, you can turn to Proverbs 3, verses 1 through 13. Understand that in the language here is about a father, and it says, my son. So do you remember in Proverbs, when we talk, oftentimes on Mother's Day, we use Proverbs 31. And Proverbs 31 was read every Sabbath evening, kind of as a liturgy, to remind young women to remind men and women the kind of person, the idealized kind of person that a young woman should be like and that a young man should pursue. And that if a young man pursued that kind of a woman, it provided a stable, healthy, productive, life-affirming household. This is the same kind of thing. That as the father went, as the husband conducted and comported himself in the home, so it transferred in the home itself the health and vitality. The more honorable, the more virtuous, the more godly a man was, the more that transferred positively in the home of the children and the wife that he had. So this isn't one of those things that's just that benefits just men. It benefits the family through these kind of men. And there are three dynamics that we read here. And I want you to keep them in mind as we work through this text for a few minutes. Excuse me. Number one, this text implies the father's intentional instruction. So the father is intentionally instructing. He's not just always waiting for the teachable moments. Those are important. But he's intentionally instructing his son throughout the course of his life. That is implied here. There's an intentionality. So we as fathers, as would-be fathers, as grandfathers, we are never off the job when it comes to intentionally instructing our children. We're always on. Number two, that he conveys godly wisdom and the benefits of that. That if you follow this wisdom that I'm about to tell you, here are the benefits. There's benefits to living your life with wisdom, he's saying. So you'll see this. He'll provide a statement that's of wisdom, and then he'll talk about the benefit that comes from following that wise advice. And then number three, that there's a call in this text to embrace godly wisdom and to reject worldly wisdom. I mean, worldly wisdom is kind of like, you wouldn't normally put those two things together, right? But sometimes the world sees it as wisdom. And so I put wisdom in quotes there. So those three dynamics are at work here. So let's look at the text. Verse 1. My son, do not forget my teaching. Keep my commandments or instruction in your heart. My son, do not forget my teaching, but keep my commandments. Hold on to them in your heart, in the most important and intimate place in your life. I want you to put those commandments there. Benefits. For, if you do this, for they will prolong your life many years and bring you prosperity. And not just prosperity in terms of material things, but riches in life, relationships, rewards. For they will prolong your life. So look, if you tell your children not to do drugs, that's wisdom. And they choose to do drugs and they die as a part of the opioid crisis, they have not lived a long life. There's wisdom in following that instruction. There's a benefit that comes from it. And that's the kind of thing that he's talking about. If you tell your children, look, if you're going to drink alcohol, drink it responsibly. Don't get drunk. But if you drink and you drive, or if you drink in places where it's easy to have an accident, like drinking and swimming, or drinking and boating, and drinking and driving, right? You may not live long because you did not follow that wisdom. So having wisdom in life can extend your life, and it can bring a more healthy life, a benefit in that regard. Verse number three, there's an overarching wisdom and its practice implied here. Let love and faithfulness never leave you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Now, so there's this, you know, as true to form, when Jewish people wrote, they wrote in a very poetic sort of way. And so the two most important things here, love and faithfulness. Now, when you talk about love, of course, that's this choice to love somebody, right? This agape thing. But faithfulness always implies not only an act of commitment, but it implies an act of commitment to a truth. So love, and I'm going to be faithful to what I know is true. So truth is implied. Let love and faithfulness never leave you. Bind them around your neck. Now, if you wanted to hold something close to you so that somebody could not get it off of you, where would you put it? You'd put it around your neck, right? Because, or around your belt. But those would be the two places that you would put something that's most precious to you. So bind them around your neck and write them on the tablet of your heart. That's how important this stuff is. You cannot let it go. You cannot let it fall from you. Put it around your neck and on the tablet of your heart. So later on, in the New Testament era, the Pharisees would have things called phylacteries. You know what phylacteries are? So phylacteries were verses of scripture, often wisdom scripture. And they would type it on a, they would not type it, but they would carve it or write it on a little wooden or stone tablet of sorts. And they would put those phylacteries around their neck, around their arm. And I'm fairly certain this text was one of the things that informed them to do that. Now, you know, some Pharisees put phylacteries around the top of their head so that they could look like really holy, you know? But that's where that whole idea came from. was to take these precious writings, this wisdom, to put it around your neck so you would never lose it. Then he goes on to say, what are the benefits? Then you will find favor and a good name in the sight of God and man. So if you live according to this wisdom, you will find favor. People will respect you. People will trust you. People will look to you. And you will win their favor. And you will have a good name. I mean, have you ever been around a person that said, oh, you can't trust them? You can't trust them. Can't trust a word that comes out of their mouth. You can't trust anything that they say that they will do. One of the things that I love in a church is when I have a person in a church and I say, would you be willing to do thus and such? And it's like they are a fire and forget missile. You've asked them and you can just consider it to be done. And it will be done with excellence. I've had other people in the church over the years where I've asked them to do a very important thing. And like the day before or an hour before, they call me, hey, man, I can't do that. I have to rearrange my sock drawer. I'm sorry. And then, you know, they're gone. And I'm left holding the bag. And all these people are depending on this thing to happen. And it doesn't happen. I can't trust them anymore. Because they weren't loving. And they weren't faithful. They didn't bind those things to themselves. These are the things that we need to teach our children. These are the things that need to be evident in our own lives so that our children not only see, hear it, but they see it in our lives as well. And if we are not these things, it makes it really difficult to convey the importance and the truth of them. He goes on to say, verse 5, about trusting the wisdom of God and not our own. He says, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not onto your own understanding. Look, trust that God will be faithful. Don't trust your own wisdom. Trust the wisdom of God. Do not trust the wisdom of man. Don't trust your wisdom. Don't trust the world's wisdom. That's what he's saying here. And the benefit is, in all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will make your path. Whatever you do, whatever you say, whatever credit you get, whatever effort you try to make, you acknowledge that God is a part of that equation. You lean on him. You trust him. You look to him for guidance. And when you do that, he will make your path straight. So it's another kind of metaphor. It's an allegory of sorts. We've all been on those windy trails like this. And we're like, you know, like for example, when Ruth and I got married, we went down to, give me that little town, Ruth, we went to, what's that?
Gatlinburg.
Gatlinburg, yeah, thank you. Gatlinburg, Virginia.
Tennessee.
And, yeah, I remember it well. So, anyway. So, but we decided we were going to come back the Skyline Highway. Did you ever do the Skyline Highway? It's miserable. I mean, it's great for about an hour. But I kid you not, it's like this. And by the time you've gone 3 hours, you know, 3 hours or so, you've gone like 100 miles. I mean, it's just, as a crow flies, you've only gone this far because the path is like this. The road is like that. We weren't making any progress at all. It's like that. That God straightens all that out. And your goal becomes clear. And the effort to get to that goal becomes much easier. When we trust in the Lord with all of our heart, when we don't lean onto our own understanding. And so he reiterates here in verse 7, do not trust worldly wisdom. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Do not be prideful about what you think you know. Fear the Lord and shun evil. I can't do these things because I respect God. I'm not going to do these things because this is evil. I'm going to shun it. I'm not going to participate in this. Leaving it behind. And what's the benefit of that? This will bring health to your body and nourishment to your bones. And so, you know, back then, if you were unhealthy, it had much more in the way of dire consequences than what it does today. So in our world today, how many safety nets do most of us have if we are unhealthy? Even if we lose our job because of a lack of health, most of us will never starve. We won't have the kind of abundant life we may have had before, but most of us will never starve. I mean, you kind of have to make it your life's work to starve in our country. You know, there are so many safety nets, but that was not true back then. So if you didn't fear God, if you ran towards evil, and you did things you should not do, your body would be impacted. This phrase here, nourishment to your bones, is very fascinating because really, to the Jews, the strength of the bone, there was a direct correlation between how strong one's bones were, the vitality and strength of their life. So if your bones are strong, your life is strong. Verse 9, honor the Lord with your wealth, with the first fruits of all your crops. So if you really love God, you understand that what you get, the first part of that belongs to Him. You honor and glorify Him with your first fruits, He's saying. So just as in lip service, now you give to serve God. And what are the benefits? Then your barns will be filled to overflowing, and your vats will brim over with new wine. That God brings blessing to us, to those who give, who honor Him in that way. So you think, but I need this, and you may need it. But what you need more is you need to trust more than what your need is. And by trusting Him more, He blesses you. That's what He's saying here. And there are many people in here, we could tell you exactly what I'm talking about. You know exactly what I'm saying about how God has blessed you. Verse 11, my son, do not despise the Lord's discipline and do not resent His rebuke. So now this is kind of intensifying. It's moving from like, this is how I want you to live your life in everyday affairs to, this is how I want you to engage God. I want you to give to God. I want you to bless Him with your giving. And here in verse 11, my son, do not despise the Lord's discipline. Because God does discipline those whom He loves, doesn't He? That's what the author of Hebrews tells us, that if He loves you, He will discipline you, me. Most of us don't discipline our children because we hate them. We discipline our children because if they continue on in that path, they will become something that will be very destructive to them. And we hate the thought of that. And so as much as we hate to distress our children through discipline, we hate even more the thought of what would happen if we didn't. And so we love them because of that. And that's what the Lord does with us. My son, do not despise the Lord's discipline and do not resent His rebuke. This is all a message. This is all part and parcel of what we need to convey to our kids. Verse 12, because the Lord disciplines those whom He loves as a father, the son He delights in. And then verse 13, blessed is the one who finds wisdom and the one who gets understanding. Blessed is the one who finds wisdom and the one who gets understanding. James tells us in James 1:5, if any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him. We live in a world where there is an incredible dearth of wisdom in the lives of our children, and that dearth is there because of two reasons. One, because the forces of counter-wisdom, the forces of false wisdom, have never been more powerful than what they are in the world today. They have never been more powerful. And our fathers have never been weaker in conveying wisdom than what they have been today. And so if we're wondering why we see what we see in our culture today, that's the reason. The enemy and the world want the hearts and the minds of our children. And fathers and grandfathers and men who are going to be fathers, you and I have a responsibility to step up and to take that hill and to never relinquish it. We have a crucial responsibility. to protect and to guide and to guard the hearts and the minds of our children. And I am telling you that there are a myriad of forces out there arrayed to win the hearts and minds of our children over to their cause. That is not about God. That's not wise. There's nothing in there about fearing the Lord, about reverence for Him, about comporting their lives in such a way that it pleases Him. And I'm just saying to every man here that if we don't take our responsibility more seriously, if we don't run towards that responsibility, if we are not intentional with that responsibility, and if you are a young man, if you are not open to your father's instruction, when it's good instruction especially, you are arrogant and you are prideful, and you are listening to the wisdom of the world. Every man that I know in here, as much as I know you, love your children, and you would probably die for your children. And if that's the kind of man you are, then you are worthy to be heard when you want to instruct your children and your grandchildren with wisdom. You've earned that right. If you're a stepfather, if you're a father-in-law, you have wisdom. And if you're an in-law to that father-in-law, glean that wisdom. There's so much more that I can say. I got all of this. Maybe I'll pick it up next week. I don't know. But all I know is that I've been a youth minister and I've been a studier of culture for most of my life. There are any number of things that we can do to help bring about the kingdom, to restore the world in which we live. I suppose there's some programs, some ideas, or things that the churches can do. But at its most basic level, its most fundamental root, if you and I as men don't do our job, I think nothing else matters. It begins with us. And we have to see it through. So as we explore what our future is as a church, one of the primary pieces, one of the primary cogs, is this challenge to every man who comes to this church to be the man of God that you've been called to be, to intentionally engage your children and your grandchildren and your nieces and your nephews, and to be a repository of redemptive wisdom in their life. To speak in whatever way that is appropriate and to counter the destructive wisdom of this world. If that doesn't happen, nothing else matters. So I think down the road, what I think we need to do as a church is that I think that we need to create a covenant of sorts over this very thing. I'm going to give that some thought and maybe propose that to you, that we make a covenant with each other as men, that we will be that kind of person in a world that is feckless and unvirtuous and self-serving in that kind of a way.